This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakweowasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's your old pal, Benjamin the Donkey.
Hi, Benji. Happy New Year. Why do I feel so disingenuous when I say those words? You know, some of my friends say this is the last time we'll have the opportunity to say Happy New Year, while others act like the predicament in which we find ourselves is all my fault for speaking the truth as I see it. What shall I do?
Here are a few tips about coming to terms with doom psychologically. Jaded. Surprised at the worsening trend of horror to comprehend? Sure, everything's wrecked, but it's what to expect when the world comes to an end. I'm more and more certain of late that we haven't much longer to wait. I believe more and more we can't change what's in store, and ever more strongly in fate. Hee-haw!
You're probably right. In fact, it looks to me like our efforts to control our fate just make matters worse. That's why the action agendas that are coming from some of our most beloved contemporary thinkers and activists scare the daylights out of me. Besides, have you noticed that all of the proposed solutions require universal agreement? Or at least cooperation and consent? And when has this species ever demonstrated such a level of trust? That's why I'm coming around more and more to the notion of right action. I can only do what I can do. I can't tell others what they must do, or even persuade or coerce them into doing things my way. I had a conversation with valve turners Annette Clapstein and Emily Johnston about their blockade of the pipelines that bring Canadian tar sands crude across the border to the U.S. refineries, and I was able to express my outrage at their prosecution as felons when it's really the corporations that should be prosecuted for sucking our beloved planet dry and transporting this dangerous contraband across borders and through our communities. But of course, that's not going to happen. We reached and passed peak oil decades ago, while the energy demands of our civilization have continued to increase, along with our population numbers and the standard of living in the so-called developing world. So, welcome to Sequitur, Annette and Emily. You know, the corporate media has been even less forthcoming with coverage of your actions 15 months ago than they were with Standing Rock. We spotlighted the actions of the Standing Rock Sioux several times here on Sequitur, but to be quite honest, that action completely overshadowed yours, along with the protests about the POTUS election. For one thing, the Standing Rock action had literally 1,000 times as many participants as yours, and numbers still mean a lot in terms of garnering media coverage. So, to compensate for the difference in visibility, I want to encourage our listeners to spend some time on the Panina page for this show especially with Steve Lipte's excellent 7-minute video, and I want to give you plenty of time to introduce yourselves to our listeners before we get into the details of your court case. Go ahead, Annette.
I have been an activist since I was in my teens during the Vietnam War, and I spent my adult life working for the Puyallup tribe as staff attorney. And so I have been very concerned with social justice and environmental things pretty much my entire life. I came into doing this particular action after about 5 years of very intensive climate-focused action. I'm a member of the Seattle Raging Grannies, and the Grannies are an international group of older leftist women who, basically it's street theater, but we've also done some blockades and things as we feel they are needed. It's a very loose-knit organization, has no hierarchy, but there are groups all across the U.S. and Canada. And in 2012, we had what we call an unconvention, which we do every 2 years. And we actually had a resolution, which is unusual. And the resolution was that as grannies, we would focus on climate change because it was the overarching problem that every other social justice and environmental problem was going to be swamped by if we did not resolve it. The Seattle Grannies took that very seriously, and we started when we got back to Seattle by attempting to lobby every conceivable political politician in office. We wrote letters to everybody. We asked for meetings. We asked them what exactly were they going to do about climate change. And in many cases, we actually got meetings. We met with a bunch of the city council and county council and some of our state legislators. And basically their response was to kind of pat us on the heads and say, oh, isn't that wonderful what you're doing, and do nothing. I can't say that was a total surprise, but the degree to which we basically got non-response was kind of appalling. So it only confirmed my sense that we live in a system which is utterly unresponsive to the citizens, which allegedly are being represented by it. And I came personally to the point where I felt I had to put my body on the line. And my first direct action in climate change issues was to blockade an oil train in Anacortes, Washington, about 4 years ago. And that was the first oil train blockade in the Pacific Northwest, I think, or one of the very first. And then I went back to the grannies and said, you know, maybe we as grannies need to start stepping up and doing some blockades. So we did, and we were very involved in the Shell No campaign when Shell tried to put their Arctic drilling rig, or did put their Arctic drilling rig, in the port of Seattle to stage for drilling in the Arctic. And those of us who were involved in climate change issues, indigenous issues, environmental issues in Seattle were outraged by this. It was a very backdoor kind of deal where they kind of tried to sneak it under the radar. And they probably regret that now because we kind of rose up and got this huge campaign. And the grannies were very involved in that, including shutting down the port. Every entrance to the port where the rig was shut down for a day, and we locked down to our rocking chairs, which we have done numerous times now, and actually made them cut us out. We refused to unlock. So I've been involved in a lot of direct action as well as every other conceivable kind of attempts to legally approach this. I mean, I was a lawyer, so I do know what it means to work within the system. And my conclusion from that is the system doesn't work. So this particular action last summer, Emily, I contacted me a few months before and said, there's going to be some kind of action that involves going out of town and may involve serious legal consequences. And I had both the Raging Grannies Unconvention was happening in Seattle, and my son was getting married. So I said, well, unless it's after both of those events, I can't be involved. So I heard no more about it till I got back from my son's wedding. And then Emily called me and said, you know, that thing we talked about, it hasn't happened yet, and we still need somebody. Do you want to come and talk to me? So that was how I became involved in this. I was one of the last people recruited for this action. But when I heard we would be planning to shut down all of the tar sands oil pipelines coming into the United States, I felt that for me as an older, retired white woman who has the privilege of not worrying about the cops showing up and shooting me, which is not the case for a lot of my younger activist friends of color, I felt that, you know, I'm also retired. I'm in a position where it doesn't matter if I get a felony conviction because I am not planning to go back to work. And I was willing to do the jail time if necessary. So I really didn't hesitate. I felt this was my job to do this. This is my job. I have grown children and I feel I have to do everything in my power to protect future generations because we really are at the point where if we don't put a stop to the fossil fuel industry, civilization will certainly collapse and human extinction is a real possibility. So I feel it's my job for a person in my position to step up and do everything that is in my power to do. And that's what I did in this case.
I'm hearing some really convincing arguments that even if we do step up and stop the fossil fuel industry, we're headed for inevitable collapse. And I'm feeling some uneasiness about what I perceive is an attachment to a favorable outcome. All of your effort, even if you're successful, we're likely to be done as a species.
Let me jump in here because this is actually something I feel super strongly about.
Go ahead, Emily.
We don't get to decide what success looks like, and the range of possible catastrophe is enormous. So to my mind, it's a moral responsibility to save anything we can. It may or may not be humanity. It may or may not be civilization. It may or may not be a large number of the species that we know and love. But what we know, again, is that there is something in the range of between 10% biodiversity loss and 95% biodiversity loss that we are facing right now. Mm-hmm. And we also know that there's, you know, somewhere in the range between hundreds of millions of people displaced and dying prematurely, or all humans dying and, you know, humanity going extinct. It's an exercise in vanity to some degree to quibble about where we fall on there, or whether it's, quote, too late or not too late. I really hate that framing because too late for what? Too late for whom? So, you know, I think it's really important. The people who are saying, well, you know, no matter what we do now, gosh, it's all over, isn't it? That's an excuse for inaction. And even if it's true, even if humanity is going extinct either way, first of all, it is clearly still possible for there to be less disaster left behind in our wake than there would be if we just keep merrily going on the route that we're on. And second of all, like whether I personally die next year or 10 years from now or 30 years from now matters to me quite a lot. And I have a feeling that most beings on the planet feel the same way. And so the idea that it doesn't matter for us to slow that down, or it doesn't matter for us to moderate it, is absurd to me.
I'm glad you said that. I agree with you 100%, and I wasn't implying that it wasn't worth it to slow it down. I'm a strong believer in right action, but mm-hmm. I'm also a strong believer in detachment from the outcome so that you don't burn out. I see so much activist burnout, and it breaks my heart. These are wonderful people doing wonderful things.
Sure.
Completely shot down and disempowered. And I'm hearing from you a sense of, to you, it sounds like success means that you did the action. It doesn't mean what the results of the action is.
Yes and no, because I mean, it matters to me. I try hard to be strategic, and I am a law-abiding activist every day of the week, as well as somebody who's willing to engage in, you know, high legal risk civil disobedience. So I would argue that we need to be detached from, well, put it this way, we need to lose our egos around attachment to very specific outcomes. That is absolutely the case. But in terms of feeling detached, I will never feel detached, and I don't want to feel detached. Detachment is definitely not my goal. It is because we are attached to this earth and to everyone else, to each other and to all our sort of sister and brother species, that this matters. I will never be sort of cold-blooded about it. I will try to be as, like I said, as strategic as I can be, and trying to get the best possible outcome does matter to me. It's just that I know I can't know what that best possible outcome is. And I know that even if it looks, by the time that I die, like I failed miserably, it's still possible I did something really good and kept things from being worse. So it's really, to a large degree, about leaving ego behind and to need behind the sense that, oh, I did that. Look, I did that, you know, which is, I mean, it's a great feeling in some ways. It's a feeling that I had, you know, Annette was talking about Shell Know. And to some degree, I had that feeling when Shell announced it was giving up its Arctic drilling. And having that feeling sometimes, there's nothing wrong with it because it can keep you going and it can make you feel powerful. But if that's what you're in it for, is that feeling of success or that feeling of power, then you're going to have a lot of heartache. You're going to burn out, and you're going to be hard to work with too, for that matter.
Yeah. And that's what I tell activists. I say, you know, don't do it because you think you're going to accomplish this, that, and the other thing. Do it because you can't not. Just because I can't sit still while this is happening.
Yeah, I think all of us came at least to some extent from that mindset. I've heard every one of us say that at some point or another, you know, I couldn't do it otherwise. I can't live with myself if I don't do this. Have my kids say, what did you do? And say, well, you know, I didn't do everything I could.
There's a terrific article written about our friend Michael Foster in Seattle Met magazine. And in that article, Ken had a really good quote about there being basically people in this world who simply can't look away from this problem. That's the thing that I recognized in Annette. That's the thing that other people recognized in me. There is an inability to live a normal life after a certain point and not be concerned about this.
I can't unknow this. I can't unsee.
Right. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I want to take a musical break to hear from my dear East Bay activist friend, Betsy Rose of Occupella, with her delightful Lullaby for the Earth, co-written and produced by Francis Aubrey.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. But if that mockingbird's extinct, how can a mama sleep a wink? Before those mockingbirds are gone, Mama's gonna sing out a mournful song about what we're putting in the air. It's changing weather everywhere. The earth's getting hot, the fields are dry. We can't grow food with a lullaby. Oceans rising, storm winds roar, tornadoes howling at our door. Oh, little darling, Mama fears hard times coming for her baby dear. But Mama is strong and Mama is wise. She'll find other mamas who'll open their eyes. We brought you life, we gave you birth. Together we mamas can save your earth. So hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna save you the mockingbird. Mama's gonna save you the maple trees, the waves of grain and the shining seas. And when we've cooled this climate down, you'll still be the sweetest little baby in town.
That was Lullaby for the Earth by Francis Aubrey and Betsy Rose. So now, can you tell us a little bit about your activist history, Emily?
My brother told me about global warming when I was like 10 or 11, and it was immediately disturbing to me, both because I have a really strong sense of connection to nature, and also because he was telling me about it on a small island on Cape Cod where I grew up spending summers that is very low-lying, and it's still my favorite place in the world. And I immediately thought like, oh, this is toast. This place that I love is done. And so there was that sense of, if this thing is true, everything I understand or everything I know about this world is up for grabs, basically, about life and what happens now. And then the same brother gave me, or at least recommended to me, End of Nature when it came out in 89, so I was 23. And I really never stopped worrying about it after that. And I went out of my way to do as much reading as I could and, you know, to understand what was going on and how the scientific opinions were shifting as to how likely it was, how bad it was going to be, how soon, what we could do about it, all those things. But, you know, I'm fundamentally a very introverted person, and I'm not very well suited to activism in some ways and sort of going to protests and rallies and stuff like that. It's always hard for me. It's even still hard for me, and I do it all the time now. So I resisted being an activist for a long time and basically just kept hoping that there were people who knew what they were doing who were solving it. And as time went on, it became abundantly clear that the people who knew what they were doing were not by themselves able to solve it. There were too many pressures working against them. And so when Jim Hansen made his game over for the climate comment in 2011, in the lead up to the Keystone XL protest at the White House, that's basically the moment at which I decided I couldn't look myself in the mirror anymore if I didn't go, if I didn't join in and see whether that would have any impact. And I actually had very little faith that it would have any impact. But I also knew that my staying home that week and doing nothing related to climate change would also not have an impact. And so I thought I might as well, you know, give a chance to see whether there could be political movement based on hundreds of us showing up to get arrested at the White House. And so, you know, I did that. And then I came back and somebody suggested I meet up with a guy named Carlo, who had also been there, but not exactly when I was. So we did meet up. The, you know, 350.org was asking folks to have house parties after that in their own areas to figure out like what they might want to do together going forward, try to start to seed, you know, some sense of climate community. My immediate thought coming back from DC was like, too bad I live basically on the edges of nowheresville as far as the climate is concerned. Why would Seattle, a place where there is no resource extraction, have anything to do with climate activism? And there was none at the time. There was no climate movement here at all. And I mean, there were lots of people working on climate issues, but there was not a grassroots movement. And so Carlo and I, along with our friend Ahmed, did a couple of protests that were very small and not very well organized. And we didn't really know what we were doing. And we had no affiliation of any kind. Carlo wanted us to do something up one of the Anacortes refineries because he found out that they were taking tar sands crude in. And then there was the first year that Shell had one of its Arctic drilling rigs here in town. And actually, you know, we had a vigil about that. I was appalled to find that out, and also appalled that I actually kind of only found out by accident. None of the environmental groups in town were doing anything about it or saying anything about it, really. Greenpeace eventually did have a small action about it. So we did a tiny vigil. There was like at most 15 of us. And then overnight, there were maybe three of us, you know. And so about a year later, somebody that Carlo knew told him that she wanted to start a 350 chapter. And he looped me in and said, let's give it a try, basically. And so we did. And we didn't really know what we were doing at first. None of us had really been organizers. But, you know, nevertheless, people would show up and people were interested. And so we kind of gradually began to cohere as a group and to do things. And then the sort of seminal moment for me in all of that was the Shell No fight. Like, it had been about a year and a half or almost 2 years that we had started. And I happened to be the person who led on that particular campaign. And I got to work with some really amazing organizers from around the country who came in specifically for that fight. And I watched them and I was blown away, basically, by how effective people could be. And, you know, I just started to actually learn what it means to be an organizer and how to do it and how to facilitate meetings and how to get a group of 60 people in a room who have deeply different ideas of how something should go, get them to keep moving forward nonetheless, you know, and feel heard. I mean, I'm still don't really consider myself an organizer exactly, but I knew one when I saw one. And that was a really great experience. And I helped to drive, you know, that, like I said, the 350 Seattle response to that, you know, which meant doing a lot of comms work and just sort of, you know, shaping how things happened. And, you know, it was great. And then the fact that we won was just amazing. After the rig left, I had a good few weeks of being very depressed and thinking that we had accomplished nothing and thinking like all that work, because we had put in like 14, 16 hour days for like 6 months at that point. And, you know, we delayed them by like 45 fucking minutes or something. And so, you know,
it was a little better than that. It was hours. Come on, Emily.
You know, the value of activism, basically, at that point. Because I just thought, like, we are so outgunned. They are just going to nail us. Like, what can we do?
You know, if you're obsessed with a quest, but find that you've given your best, and you have to conclude we're still totally screwed, it's probably time for a rest. Hee-haw.
And then we got word not only that Shell had given up its Arctic drilling program, but also that a board member had explicitly said that they had done so partly because they hadn't hit pay dirt in the way they expected from one particular well, but also because they were acutely aware of the reputational concerns And what they meant by that was basically us. Everything that we had done and everything the folks in Portland had done to bring attention to this issue and to make sure that, like, nothing happened about those rigs without public attention to how devastating Arctic drilling is. I mean, it was really incredible serendipity that the Nature article came out the week before the Port of Seattle announced that we were going to be hosting Shell's rigs. And what that article had said was, here are the fossil fuel projects we cannot engage in and hope to stave off climate catastrophe. You know, these are the things we cannot do, basically, the lines we cannot go beyond. And one of those things was Arctic drilling. And so on the one hand, scientists are saying, like, this is a no-go zone. We can't do this if we want to have a stable climate. And then the next week, the Port of Seattle, who are a bunch of elected commissioners, you know, say, hey, by the way, we in Seattle are going to host these things. Yeah, so it was a real gift of a fight in a lot of ways, because it went against Seattle's self-image. And so we were able to leverage that self-image of being like a green and reasonable place against the devastation of that kind of project. And so it was a great fight. And I mean, at that point also, both our group, specifically Thrifty Seattle, had cohered pretty well at that point, although it's gotten much better since then, I would say. But starting then, you know, and with learning so much from the organizers who came in from elsewhere and from making great connections within Seattle as well with other organizers who hadn't necessarily been very focused on climate before, all of those things just worked together to really make the movement here very powerful force and a very powerful sort of emotional community, I would say. There are just so many great people who are doing this work. I mean, when you're thinking about climate change pretty much all day, every day, you need that, because it's an incredibly distressing thing to think about, and we know that we're losing. And so obviously, as Annette mentioned, and you said, you know, we're in there because we can't not do this work. But it's no good, as you also said, if you run yourself into the ground or if you just completely burn out because you're feeling so hopeless. And so for me, what really fights that is the community here.
Totally agree. We have a wonderful activist community here in Seattle, and that is what keeps me in, especially the young activists. I'm just so impressed with the young folks we have and how good they are at what they do. I mean, I don't know if we win at all, but, you know, we're sure going down fighting with a hell of a good bunch of people.
I'm actually feeling kind of tighter in the throat hearing this, because I have information from my end of the climate watchers that the drilling is proceeding in the Arctic. After all, what happened, I think we got the Arctic Circle weather going down here in the eastern United States, and they've got our weather up there in the Arctic Circle, and there's all kinds of records being set for minimal sea ice and all kinds of craziness going on up there. And Guy McPherson is fond of quoting the, I don't remember if he's the Norwegian president or the Finnish president, somebody up there in Scandinavia, telling Mr. Trump in the White House at a conference that if we lose the Arctic, we lose the planet. And that's real. And so are the wildfires in Southern California. I mean, I have people all over the place, and my heart goes out to all of them.
It was the whole coast, not just California. For the first time ever, we had weather forecasts this summer in Seattle, which were smoke. I have never seen that as a weather prediction, but day after day, we had smoke choking, ash falling from the sky from all the forest fires up and down the entire West Coast. It was,
right.
It was a horrible.
It's not just forest fires anymore. We live in such a plastic world that smoke is much more toxic. It's not just about the particulates anymore. It's about the airborne chemicals.
And there's so much development on the edges of the forest. I mean, Santa Rosa, California, a good bit of it burned down. I mean, there were people burned out of their houses, again, all up and down the coast. Ken Ward, who shut down the pipeline here in the state of Washington, lives in Oregon near the Columbia Gorge. He was evacuated from his house. He had 15 minutes warning to get out of his house, and he evacuated with his son, and they were okay. And as it happened, the fire stopped short of their house. So his house did not burn down, but it was a very big threat. So even among ourselves, you know, those of us who did this action have been directly affected by it.
Strange days. We're surprised every time we detect something new in our lives getting wrecked. We're dismayed bit by bit as our world turns to shit. But what else then did we expect? Hee-haw!
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Have you ever wondered how people handle doom? Why, it's really very simple. Whenever we suffer malaise, we address it in various ways, but we deal with the threat by learning to set the right neurotransmitters ablaze.
Is that right? That's all it is.
But that's so easy.
Hee-haw!
Well, I don't have any ruby slippers, so I can think of no better way within the confines of this reality to set those neurotransmitters ablaze than with a Sunset Windows practice by Elizabeth West. Your mic is live, Elizabeth.
Hi, Susan. It's good to be back on Sequitur with another Sunset Windows practice. This one is called Choosing for Yourself. The basic premise here is that there's far more support available to all of us than we usually tend to remember or to realize. And accessing that support is frequently a matter of just bringing awareness to what it is that we are seeking or looking for, and being very clear with ourselves and the invisible but potent forces that are all around us or within us to assist us in living as we would like to live. This practice is essentially a simple means of specifying, of being clear about what we want and either, quote unquote, putting it out there or focusing it within, depending on your own personal vision of how things work in this universe. Done consistently, it can really alter your experience in some interesting ways. The directions, as usual, are simple and the investment of time is minimal. So I would suggest that you plan to practice this one for a number of days on end, 4 or 5 at very least. But before you start your segment of practice, before you set out, the first thing that you want to do is to compose for yourself one prayer, a wish, or entreaty, or clear vision, something short, 2 sentences, no more, that encapsulates your wish for yourself for the day. And I'd suggest that you start with just yourself. Don't add humanity or loved ones or the earth or other beings or anything of that sort just yet. Start with yourself. So a very short and clear definition of what you'd like and write it down. And you also might want to think about who or what you want to entreat or address this to. Do you want to address it to God, to the universe, to the Great Spirit, to nature, to earth, to your own higher nature, etc.? You can decide, but it's nice to know who you're talking to in your own heart. And then once you have this clear wish encapsulated in writing, you read it aloud and repeat it for a total of 3 times with attention and intention each morning, and you intend that it stay with you throughout the day. So you get clear about something you'd like for yourself. You read it out loud 3 times with attention and intend that it stay with you. Now, it's nice to put the written version by your bed or your coffee maker or your refrigerator or your computer, someplace where you'll see it when you wake up in the morning. And then at the end of the day, it helps to review the color, the quality of your day before you turn in. Notice when your prayer was answered or responded to and give thanks. Or touch into gratitude, if you can, for any of the answers that came through, even if it was a lot less than you'd hoped for. And you just do that same thing. You get up in the morning and you read this wish 3 times and intend that it stay with you, and then check in at the end of the day to see what happened. That's all. It shouldn't take more than 5 minutes to compose your wish. And beyond that, you'll be committing to no more than 3 or 4 minutes every day to read the prayer in the morning and to review it before you sleep. And at the end of the week, you'll notice a change in all likelihood in your experience of life. It may be nuanced, but there will be something that moves you if you give yourself fully to those 3 minutes a day. Very simple. I have a couple of different experiences that I thought I would share to illustrate how it might work. The first time I worked with this was my prayer. Dear universe, please help me to turn my gaze toward the beauty, both within and without, particularly when I am tempted by tragedy. Please help me to know and to dive deeply into the joy and the light that are everywhere, always. Thank you. So I had a hard time remembering this one, and it really helped me, I noticed, when I had something, a reminder, a big piece of paper next to my bed to remember to do it. And during the day, when I had read it out loud first thing in the morning, the awareness of that wish came and went. But I did notice that there were more moments when I was, say, idly scanning the world, whether it be the clouds, people passing me on the street, maybe some food I was preparing, when I was drawn dramatically into the wonder and awe that seemed to me to be the truth that I am want to ignore often. For instance, a red pepper, the color, the shape, the flavor, the cellular structure, it's totally miraculous. And it feeds me in so many ways. How many peppers have I cut up and cooked and consumed without any reverence at all? These moments of delight that I had, of dropping into the awareness of the beauty and perfection that was just on my cutting board, have increased a lot with the daily use of this practice. I had a couple of good days when things were easy and life seemed to be on my terms. I also had a couple of awful days during the time I was working with this first time, when I was struggling to do even the simplest of things. And not surprisingly, the gratitude flowed more freely on the easy days, but it has been more important to me, even if a little harder to connect with, on the difficult days. So I didn't find that it transformed me, but I was a little stronger, a little happier, a little more connected. And I felt a potential that has taken on a little more form, has become a little more accessible to connect with the rest of the world and to feel that joy more often than I have in the past. On another occasion, my wish was simply, I want to be kind to myself. And when I sat and asked, this was the entreaty that arose. It wasn't directed to anything beyond myself. So I asked for help doing this. The following day, as I got up and started to repeat this prayer, this wish, I found that what arose was, I want to be gentle with myself. So I repeated that, not I want to be kind with myself, but I want to be gentle with myself. And several days on, my morning entreaty was, I want to fully love myself. And I allowed the intention to evolve and to grow. And some evenings I was able to see more in terms of concrete manifestation, but the shifts in the nature of the prayer showed me how I was in fact becoming more open-hearted with myself each day as I used this practice, which of course was a beautiful thing. That's choosing for yourself. Do you have any thoughts, Susan, or responses?
I do. I'm very excited by what you've shared. I noticed a couple of things. First of all, I guess that I'd like to spotlight. One is that this is the first practice, I think, where you set it up for the whole week in the very beginning, rather than anew each time. And yet, in contrasting the two examples that you gave, I noticed that if the wish or the prayer or the entreaty evolves, that's okay too. You don't have to be stuck with something that becomes irrelevant or is awkward. You know, if it's not working, you can always tweak it. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of keeping the same overarching or underlying, depending on how you look at it, intention. You strung a lot of words together, wish, entreaty, prayer, and you didn't say request. And that's what was ringing in my mind, was request. This is kind of like a request, isn't it?
I guess you could call it a request, but, you know, it's almost more a request of oneself. And you can put it out to the universe, you can put it out to God, but it's a way of focusing. And maybe there is some force that is drawn in and supports us from without when we ask for it. Certainly that's been my experience at certain times. But there's also a huge amount of power, really, that we abdicate because we don't focus what it is that we want. We wander through our lives and we're not paying attention and we're not deciding what we want to pay attention to, or we are, and we're paying attention, for instance, like I said in my first example, paying attention to tragedy. I mean, looking at what's going on in the world, I can get lost in sorrow and grief and rage and all those sorts of emotions that are appropriate in a lot of ways to what's going on, but take me down and don't do anything but add to the overwhelming quantity of negativity that's out there.
Appropriate, but self-destructive. Destruction is destruction, whether self-directed or other-directed. But back to the notion of request, I have no problem being the recipient of my own request or the target of my own request. Making requests of self does not violate anything in my worldview or anything like that. And I was very tickled that you came up with food examples, because as you were describing it, that was exactly where I went. I went with exactly where your second one was. My request only has two words: prioritize self-care. Dear Susan, would you please prioritize self-care? And so much of self-care for me has to do with food, because food is my medicine. Visualizing you at the cutting board with a red pepper was kind of sweet. And I spent some time this morning engaged with a butternut squash and had that same sort of magical feeling about this neutral-colored, obscene-shaped object that's providing me with six portions of delicious vegetable for future meals. And the gratitude, as you said, the gratitude and the reverence were just overwhelming in that moment of working with that squash, both raw and when I took it out of the steamer pot to finish skinning it and put it in the jars and everything. Whenever I was interacting with it, there was, reverence and awe were the two feelings I was most connected with. I'm also wanting to emphasize to listeners, I don't know if it's your experience, but it's been my experience with these practices and with the readings from your book, that I'm fine in the morning, but as the pressures of the world impinge upon my reality, by the time it's time to go to bed, I forget all about the evening part of it.
Yes, that is tricky. And one of the things that certainly has been really, really important to me in my pursuit of greater clarity, greater joy, greater awareness in this life is not being embarrassed about making myself reminders, because we do. We remember, we forget, we remember, we forget. Little things, big things. And we need to use the tools we have to remember as much as we can. And so I really do put sticky notes around my house because that helps me remember. Some people I know set alarms on their phones or, you know, things like that. But the point is, what works for you? Do you need to put a little sticky note on your bathroom mirror so that when you're brushing your teeth before you go to bed, you know, it says, remember to look back over your day, or even remember.
Or even something. Just set windows, if I just have those few words. I guess about reminders for me, I don't know if anybody else out there had a real nag for a mother, but I sure did. And reminders always feel like they come in my mother's voice. And I have a hard time with that.
Well, so how would you remind someone you loved?
I guess I would put it in the first person plural rather than in the second person. Not you do this, but let's us do this.
Okay. So use that, because the point of the reminder is that it is a loving nudge towards something that you have chosen on your own heart's behalf. And it is absolutely meant as just a look over here. Remember, you decided that this was something you wanted to do. And it's not in any way meant to be a nag. And if it is, obviously it's not going to work.
No, it's not meant to be. It's just a matter of that's the way I hear reminders of all kinds, no matter how lovingly delivered. There's so many things about my bedtime routine that I've been forgetting lately because it's getting much more complicated. So the idea of a note on my pillow is probably a good idea for me.
That's good. And I think it's individual what's going to work. But the idea is that you find a way to lovingly remind yourself as you would someone that you cared about.
Yeah.
And I have found over and over again with these practices exactly what you're talking about. You can start off in the morning, you can do the thing, and then if you don't kind of just check in at the end of the day, you lose some of the efficacy. You lose those moments, like when you are working with your squash, that are so big and uplifting in a certain way in this little ordinary activity. And yet it is one where your heart is big, where you're full, where you're grateful. You can have that in a moment and you can forget it. But if you come back to it at the end of the day and just kind of bow to it, say, wow, look, there were six moments during my day where I actually felt so grateful, so connected, so full of what I wanted to be full of. There is a completion there and a kind of a grounding of those experiences.
And how brilliant to write it down in the first place rather than just speak it aloud, because then I've got something I can put on my pillow.
Exactly. So you can play with and tweak the pieces of that, but that's the
general. Yeah, I can imagine using index cards. I don't like post-it notes. They always end up stuck to something irrelevant, you know. But an index card on my pillow would be...
Perfect, yes. Actually, I think that's what I used, was an index card when I was working with this the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So cool.
Anything more?
No, that's all. Thank you so much, Susan.
All right. And thank you very much for this practice of choosing for myself. We'll see you next time.
Take good care.
All righty. Now, before I return to our featured interview with Annette Clapstein and Emily Johnston, I have another song for you. This one was written specifically for the Valve Turners and is available for download at Bandcamp on a gift economy basis, with all proceeds earmarked for the Legal Defense Fund. It's called Act of Love, and it's written and performed by Erica Lundahl.
This is my act of love. This is my hand uncovered for you and me and everyone we see. This is my gift of vulnerability. This is my body. I turn the valve, I turn the key. Reveal the sorcery, the systems as they be, the systems as they be. This is fragility, what we've built our gospel on. God is not a paragon, a pentagon, a president, an oil bearer. God is you and me. God is everything you see. I am grateful for your actions to keep this place, to keep this place. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. The work we're in, the ancient hymn, breathe in.
That was Act of Love by Erica Lundahl.
So now that we've had a thorough introduction to each of you, I'd like to turn it over to Emily again and hear what this presentation is about Sunday and maybe an update from the court cases.
Do you mean the presentation of the church? That's going to be Michael. And so I'm not exactly sure what he will cover that day, but he's generally a terrific speaker. Then we are going to be in Healdsburg the next day for two fundraisers, a casual one in town and then a fancier one, you know, sort of high dollar version, one following the other. I think the first one will be quite casual and the second one will have a moderator and it's, you know, going to be more of a shindig. Usually the way that the presentations work, so, you know, I won't speak to what's happening at the church because I think that one is fairly short. I don't think it's going to be one of our usual presentations. But usually the way the presentations go is that somebody shows the video because that gives people at least a very broad sense of what we did and why and who we are. And then we each introduce ourselves a little bit and then there's some questions. The fancier one in Healdsburg might be somewhat different because there's only going to be two of us up there and there's going to be a moderator. And so I'm not sure exactly what they have in mind. All of these talks that we've done so far, whether we're doing them as a group or as one of us or as a couple of us, at least to my knowledge, they've all gone quite well and people have been really supportive.
I've been researching your situation and it looks to me like several of you have already been sentenced. How is it that you have all this freedom of movement?
Emily and I are the last to be tried, along with Steve, who made the video, and Ben, who was our support person. So we'll be the biggest trial in terms of numbers of people. Ken Ward is the only one who's gone all the way through trial and sentencing and is now filing an appeal because he was denied the use of the necessity defense. Michael Foster was convicted in North Dakota in October and will be sentenced February 6th. And Leonard Higgins was convicted in Montana in November and will be sentenced there March 20th. So they're out because they haven't been sentenced yet. And we haven't been tried yet because we were granted the necessity defense and then the prosecutor immediately appealed that decision. So that is before the Minnesota Court of Appeals now. And our lawyer says oral argument will be on February 15th. And our lawyer says they have 3 months to decide, which means probably their decision won't come down till mid-May, which means we probably won't be tried until June.
How about that? Long, drawn-out process.
Yes, it certainly is.
The other thing I wanted to ask, as long as we've got you with the mic right now, Annette, and you're the more legally conversant of the team, I keep reading these charges about interfering with critical public service facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Private corporate facilities.
Exactly. That was exactly what I said in my statement at our arraignment. I find that particularly ironic that we were charged with that because there's nothing public, obviously, about Enbridge. They are a private corporation who is doing what they're doing for profit and nothing else, even if they make their profits over the dead body of all of our future generations.
Progeny, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So there's nothing public about them and there certainly is no public service about it. We feel like we were the ones who did a public service in shutting them down. And if they stayed shut down, that would be a true public service because what they're doing is a death sentence to life on Earth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. That just affirms the complete inside out, upside down and backwards nature of our so-called legal system.
Absolutely. I mean, I often say that lawyers are actually in the best position to know how poorly the system works. If we're honest with ourselves, we're the ones who know that the criminal justice system works as it's intended to work, which is to oppress the poor and to protect capitalism and to protect big corporate capitalism most of all. And that's what it does. It is not at all about justice for ordinary citizens.
Yeah, and certainly not about truth.
Absolutely.
It was at all about truth. They could not use that sentence, critical public service facility, to describe a corporate pipeline.
It is kind of funny. It does make me laugh.
I guess I'm just too literal-minded. I can't see the humor.
Yeah. Well, because it's so ironic, but it does kind of make me laugh because it's just totally wrong.
It makes me feel sick. It actually makes me sick in my stomach.
It is sickening. What they're doing is sickening, and
the fact that we have to fight to present our reasoning for doing this, for presenting the facts of climate change to the jury. I mean, it seems to me that here we are in an absolute emergency, which is going to affect the jurors and the court and everybody else just as much as it's affecting us. And yet we need the court's permission to even present this information. And it has not been allowed in any of the other trials. They were all denied the right to a necessity defense. And we are so pleased that our judge actually listened to us. He actually held a hearing when we asked for the necessity defense. He listened to what we had to say.
Yeah, the reading that I did indicated that that's the first time that permission has been given in writing.
That's true. It's an actual written order. But of course, now it's on appeal. So we will see.
And what difference does it make? And I'm thinking here of the restraining order with the DAPL. Nod, nod, wink, wink. Go ahead, even though the court...
Well, that's exactly how they operate. Virtually every fossil fuel project that I know of has either failed to get critical permits or has continued working while they waited for them. And that's what DAPL did. They just went ahead. They didn't have it, but they figured, oh, well, pay the fines. We'll make it up in profits. They don't care. They don't follow the law. We're expected to follow the law, but they completely blow it off. You know, I have believed that we have to radically change our system. I have believed that since I was in my teens, and nothing in my life has ever changed that. If anything, it has only confirmed more and more that if we don't change the entire system we're living under, we're doomed.
As long as they're creating jobs and keeping people working.
That's their argument, and they don't even do that. I mean, I've heard that about every fossil fuel project. And if you look at most of them, they create very few jobs and most of them are pretty temporary. It's all propaganda. They don't even create a lot of jobs.
But it sells papers.
Yes, it does. And it sells them.
What else, Emily? What is your personal situation? Annette has told us that she's a retired attorney and a grandmother.
I'm the only one of the valve turners who's not retired or the equivalent. About 3-4 years into the 350 Seattle thing, we started to do some serious fundraising. And there are a few of us now who have a worker collective, basically, a staff collective. So that is how I pay the bills. And it's also how I spend all my time, pretty much. Before I did that, I was mostly making a living as a freelance writer. Before that, as a freelance web designer. Before that, as a waitress and bartender. And I've always been a writer. So I have a book of poetry out, number of essays and op-eds and things like that. I'm writing very little these days. I'm even reading very little these days, unfortunately, just because I'm so busy. With luck, I will be able to carve out some time for those, maybe in jail.
Exactly.
Put in a plug for your book and or any of the fundraising activities that would help make your life more wonderful, more livable.
Yeah, I'd love for people to read the book just because I took a lot of time and care to write it. It's called Her Animals. Financially, it doesn't do anything at all for me because it's poetry and there's no such thing as royalties for poetry, basically, from small presses.
It's an awesome book, though. She won't say, but she was nominated for some kind of state award for it.
Yeah, so I hope people will read that.
It's called Her Animals, and it's where?
And people can get it on Amazon if they have to, but the press actually loses $1 per book sold on Amazon. So people should really get it directly from the press. It's called Hummingbird Poetry. It's just hummingbirdpoetry.org. And then as far as the legal fund goes, we're in decent shape, I think. What we need right now is to have funds available, you know, the expert witness travel and all that kind of thing. Also to have some funds to at least begin the appeals with, because Ken is definitely appealing. I'm pretty sure Michael is planning to appeal. Leonard may or may not appeal. Ken already did his community service, so it's not about the sentence. And he doesn't care about having, you know, conviction on his record. The reason he's appealing is that he just passionately wants to push this issue forward in the courts. And, you know, we may or may not get our necessity defense, and we may or may not win it. And so, you know, he just feels really strongly that that's what he wants to do with his time and energy, is to try to make that happen again and try to force the courts to recognize where we're at and deal with the laws of physics as well as the laws of the nation.
If people want to contribute to the legal defense fund,
can go to shutitdown.today. That's the best place to do it. The very first time you open the site, there should be like a splash that's strictly about donation. Every time thereafter. Right now, the top page has a picture of Leonard and says Montana trial support on it. But there's also a bar across the top, and one of the items is donate.
And there's also a Facebook page, which is Shut It Down Climate Direct Action, and it also has a link to the donation.
Okay.
So, and we definitely will need money for the appeals. I mean, we've so far been able to cover the trials, but we still have ours coming up. And as I said, with four people, it's going to be more expensive probably than the others, especially if we end up doing the necessity defense and, yes, and are able to bring in all the experts.
Yeah, as soon as she said travel expenses for experts, yeah, I thought,
right,
oh my God, all those plane tickets, right?
Right.
Well, and travel expenses for us and feeding people and feeding the support team. And like, we're all going to be there for like a solid week.
Oh, at least in our case, if we actually do the necessity defense, it's going to go 2 weeks.
Yeah, the expenses add up really fast.
So I'm about ready to close it out. I'm wondering if each of you would like a few more minutes of mic time to add whatever you are feeling is burning.
I come back over and over to Mario Savio in the free speech movement, who said,
there's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
And I feel so strongly that that's where we're at with the climate, that I hope other people in my age group will step up and do what needs to be done and don't worry about what happens to the rest of your life. You know, you've had your life. I'm serious. Sure, I'm 65. I would love to see 90, but honestly, I don't think I will. In any case, with the way things are going, as things crash and burn on every level in this country, politically, economically, and of course, the climate is driving a lot of it, medical care is going to become less available. I think my generation is not going to live as long as my parents. And I'm sorry, Emily, your generation is, it's going to be even worse. And it's just going to keep going like that. So we don't have much of a future anyway. I'm talking about my generation now, you know, boomers and such. We need to step up and do this stuff. We need to put a stop to this stuff for our children, our grandchildren, the future generations that still may have some possibility of existing. And if they are existing, I want them to exist in a habitable world.
Yeah,
for sure.
Okay, Emily.
I agree completely with what Annette said. And I assume that everybody who is listening to this podcast understands where we're at to some degree in terms of climate change and how serious it is, and maybe even how urgent it is, although a lot of folks don't realize precisely how urgent it is. And I think the piece that a lot of people don't look at is that if we let this go on the way that it's going on now, then basically we are giving our consent to the end of life as we know it. And they have to run those trains, they have to run those pipelines, they have to run those tankers. They have like millions of miles of pipeline in this country. And they go through all of our communities, the oil trains, same thing, refineries. As long as we allow them to continue business as usual, we are allowing them to destroy the world as we know it. While I would always want people to be as careful as humanly possible and to do their research and to understand the consequences, the truth is that we do have to stand up to them. And at a certain point, we have to make their lives really difficult. And sometimes that's going to look like showing up 1,000 people at a hearing to make sure they don't get a permit that they need in order to keep operating or whatever. But other times it will be simply, you know, trying to blockade a train or trying to blockade a ship or turn off a pipeline. It's really important that people understand that we do have the power to withdraw our consent from them destroying our planet and running through and operating in our communities. And it also means just standing up and talking about that on a really regular basis, even though people will look at you like you have three heads. You know, it's hard. We're such a social species, and it's hard to talk about what other people are not talking about. And I understand that, and it's hard for me too. But we have to get a little tougher. And I think it's actually nice. It turns out that our talk next Monday is going to be on Martin Luther King Day. And I'm not going to belabor that by any means because I don't want to co-opt it. But I think what's really important is that people understand that even actions like ours, we've gotten a lot of people saying, people obviously on our side of the political spectrum or in our bubble, saying, you know, how brave we are. And actually, none of us believe that. It's really not very much what we did. And the truth is that other people and other movements at other times, but for similar reasons of self-preservation and preservation of what they cared about, have risked so much more and paid such a higher price And asking people to engage in direct action, asking people to engage in blockades, asking people to make time in their lives to go to hearings and make noise and make life difficult for these companies and never stop speaking the truth about what is going on right now and how we need to fix it immediately. Those things are not too much to ask. Other people have done far more.
Well, that's all for now. Hee-haw!
Special thanks to Annette Klapstein and Emily Johnston for spending the better part of last Saturday morning with me on Zoom. To their support person, Nikki Bradford, for making the interview arrangements. And to Steve Lipte and his team for producing the video you will find on the Panina page for Sequitur Pipeline Resistance. Thanks also to associate producer Elizabeth West for the concept for this show, for forging the connection with the valve turners, and for her Sunset Windows practices. To Mario Savio for his sterling example of speaking truth to power. To Francis Aubrey and Betsy Rose for Lullaby for the Earth. To Erica Lundahl for Act of Love. To Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, embellished today with a classic moment from The Wizard of Oz. And to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.